If you're looking to whet your appetite for engaging and informative talk radio, the lineup at the Fantasy Sports and Politics Network has exactly what you need. Shows like The Master Plan with Jerry the Master Taylor, Time Out with women's basketball legend Sylvia Crawley, Compassion Dakini, hosted by Kim Fung, No Chaser with Mac Williams and Jerry Taylor, the FSP Crew Show with co-hosts Jerry Black and the Joker, and the Fantasy Sports and Politics Show, all focus on the hot topics in sports, politics, and in life. By visiting fantasysportsandpolitics.webs.com, you'll gain great insight into each program and host, access to the show's archive, as well as outstanding articles, photos, and a whole lot more. As well, because of its large and steadily growing following, fantasysportsandpolitics.webs.com is a great place to advertise. Stop by today at fantasysportsandpolitics.webs.com. Information, motivation, variety.
Tell me what you want, tell me what you see, where you wanna go, what you wanna be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, still gonna need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them, then after you do, go and talk to him. Wait, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight, take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends, Twitter, you the trend, name a Bentley Benz, but you're moving kinda fast, keep sweating. You gotta make it last, live every day like it's your last, but don't forget to have a blast.
You are listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crawley. I am your host, Sylvia Crawley Milbury. And if you are listening to the show today, we actually need a jingle for this show. So if you have the ability to sing, rap, whatever it is you do musically, we are looking for a theme song for this show. Here's your chance. Tonight, we have a very, very interesting show lined up for you. The topic that we're going to deal with is a very sensitive topic. This is a PG show, so if there are any small kids, this show is not for small children. If they are 13 and over, we ask that parents that you are with your children as you listen to this show. But we have a very inspiring story. I have spent the last few days talking with this my guest, this young lady, and I have been in tears just kind of interviewing her, preparing for this show. So hopefully I've got all that out of the way. Kim, we have Kim Brownie Hodge. Kim, welcome to the show. Thank you for doing this for us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we are going to jump right into the show so that we don't run out of time this time. We do have more than an hour for the show now. By popular demand, our show has been expanded, so we have time, but we want to just kind of get right into the thick of the story. Kim, talk to us just about initially. Let's talk about what happened to you when you were betrayed by your aunts. Can you tell us the story and what happened to you?
When I was 12 years old, I was sold by my aunts to a man who lived in front of us. For $20 at that. I mean, that was the price. And I have to say, after that experience, being sold from them, I already knew that my family had this this hatred, but I never knew it was this extensive. You know, I never knew that it would come this far, basically. I mean, I was 12 and we were supposed to be going to visit someone in front because of money situation. And I ended up going to these people's home, and my aunt Harry made an agreement that she was going to sell me for $20, basically. And that was a tough thing. That was a really tough thing. That's when I really learned what hatred looked like.
So let me ask you this. Why did your aunts hate you so much?
Well, I want to say like 2 weeks ago was when it actually came out why they hated me. I never knew why they did. I just knew that I didn't fit in. Well, at my aunt's wedding, that's when she told me that the reason why they never liked me was because of the attention that my grandfather gave me that caused them not to care for me at all.
Okay, so let me inform the listeners that Kim, along with her two aunts, live with her grandparents. And Kim, explain to us, where was your mother at this time?
My mom didn't live with us. She stayed in Los Angeles, and we lived in the high desert with our grandparents.
Was she working
My mother was a school teacher at the time. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she's teaching in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And you were living with your grandparents and your aunt at your grandparents' house.
Yes.
And so because you were sort of the favorite with your grandparents, that's the reason why your aunts hated you so much.
They perceived it as me being the favorite in my grandfather's eyes. From what my grandmother used to say, it was because I didn't have anybody. There was an agreement when I was born that my mom at first didn't want any children, so she was going to have an abortion. So what my grandparents came up with was the idea that if my mom went full term, that they would legally take over. So
okay.
with that being said. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they sold you across the street for $20 and a CD, is that correct?
Yes, a CD. Player.
Now, were your aunts, were they using drugs? Was this,
no.
Why did they, it was just hatred, the reason why they sold you across the street, or did they owe these people some money, or did they owe them a favor in some kind of way?
No, there was no drugs involved. There was no amount of money that they owed them or anything like that. It was just agreement that they plotted in secret.
Wow. So this is really the story of Joseph. Like in the Bible, Joseph was, sold for 20 shekels of silver. So you get to the house across the street, and then what happened? What happened there?
Well, when we got there, my aunt, of course, went to the back room, and when she came out, we thought we were leaving, my other aunt and I. And I was asked to come into the back. And when I went into the back, that's when I noticed that things were changing. That's when my aunt let me know that these two guys would be having their way. And pretty much they never left the room. They stayed in the room, and they tried to coach me through the process.
Your aunts did?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
And once it was over, then we left, and I was not supposed to say anything from that point, or I would be left in the desert.
Wow. So you go home, and were you taken to the hospital at all? Were you were there, any kind of damages, bleeding, anything like that?
There was some bleeding involved. I was never taken to the hospital. At this time, my grandfather was deceased, and my grandmother was in the hospital. So these two aunts were the ones that were supposed to be looking over me, watching out for me. And they just kind of try to do a little bandage up, but nothing really extensive or anything. I was kind of mostly, I had to fend for myself, pretty much.
Wow. So you pretty much took care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're 12 years old at this time, so you're in middle school. How is this affecting your schoolwork and how you're performing at school?
I actually shut down. I stayed to myself. I really didn't talk that much, whether it was at church or school, especially when coming home. I really didn't socialize much. My grandmother started noticing that something was going on, but she didn't know what it was when she returned from the hospital. My grades, I pretty much still did my homework, but when it came to people, I stopped trusting people. I felt like everyone was out to, kind of hurt you, because you never suspect that the people around you would be the ones to betray you like that. So all my life we were told that we needed to be watchful of people on the outside, never warned that you need to be careful of people in your own home. So at that time I had to be kind of watchful of everyone's actions, because I started kind of getting a little paranoid, but, just just very watchful.
Right. So how were your grades? Let me ask you that. Like, what kind of grades were you getting around this time?
I was average now. Like, I was slipping to, like, C's and nothing that I was normally getting. I was more, like, in the C's area.
So B, C student, which is remarkable given what you're going through at this time.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, now you're 13 years old. Talk to me about when you turned 13, you started to cut yourself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I never really understood. I never understood cutting. You know, I always felt like if you're going to commit suicide, why would you cut but not enough to, you know, to not cut deep enough where you would end your life, but just a little bit. Is there some type of endorphins or some type of satisfaction that you get at that moment from cutting? Can you explain that? Because that's a concept that I really can't grasp.
Well, to me, each cutter is different. I mean, I can't explain other people of why they do it, but for me, when I was cutting, I was already emotionally just down. Like, emotionally, I was just checked out. So I wasn't a very big crier. I wasn't very emotional. So when I used to cut, that was like my tears. That was how I got what was in me out. I mean, I didn't have words to put, you know, I didn't have that. You know, no one knew what was going on. I didn't even feel safe enough to say anything that was going on. So when I cut, that was my tears. That's the way that I was getting it out.
Wow. Did you do anything else damaging to your body, pills or, you know, alcohol or medicine, NyQuil, anything like that?
Once I went into the foster care system, I actually started attempting suicide where I was actually overdosing on medication. At this time, I felt like my world was flipped upside down. You know, one minute I was at home, and then the next minute I was placed into a foster care system where I didn't know anybody. I felt like everything was my fault. So I was just like, I'd rather be dead than to be alive. So I would just start overdosing on medication. Sometimes people would find out about it, and that would lead to the hospitalization. Or sometimes I would take it in the middle of the night, and when I wake up in the morning, I was like, oh, well, I'm still alive. And then I just get dressed for school and go on, and people wouldn't even know what I had done.
So in our conversations, you said that there were about 29 suicidal attempts over the course of time. And each time you were one pill shy away or there was something. Did you ever feel like was there ever a time where you felt like a failure at everything, including death or suicide?
I did. I felt like I couldn't die right. I couldn't live right. I mean, it was just like I wasn't successful. I felt like I couldn't even die. You know, it was like, how simple is it for me to end it? You know, why can't I even succeed at dying?
What happened on the 29th time? Because that was that seemed to be the last time that you tried to commit suicide, but there was something that happened to cause that to be the last time. Talk to us about that time in particular.
That's the time I'll never forget. I was still in school, and well, in college, and I just kind of snapped out. And I ended up taking 30 pills that night, and I was just like, this is it. I'm done. I have nothing else to give. I just felt at the lowest point. And I remember talking with someone, and they were like, Kim, you're not sounding right. You know, I'm going to call the paramedics. You're not sounding right. The paramedics, it was like I was so good at masking things. I was, because I had been in situations like this, I knew how to word things. I knew how to mask it. I knew how to look like it was like I was okay. And that day, that morning, the paramedics came, and then there were some school officials. And so they were like, Kim, you know, we got a call that you overdosed on some medication, or it seems like you had overdosed on medication. But some of the school officials came in. They were like, oh, no, this is Kim, the Christian girl. She would never do this. And they were like, isn't that right, Kim? And there was just, like, maybe a few pills left in the bottle. And I was like, no, I would never do this. All the while, my body is shutting down. And they were like, okay, well, we'll just check back with you. So they ended up leaving. The paramedics, you know, left. Around 6 o'clock that morning, my body literally was shutting down. I remember just for me to move my fingers caused agony to my body. I just remember turning. There was no indication that I was going to live. I remember a smell to this day. It's like a Bath and Body Works smell, and I always associated with death because that was the smell. And I remember just turning my face to our closet door, and I was just like, Lord, I'm not even asking you to spare my life. Forgive me. Forgive me for being selfish. Forgive me for all these things. I'm not asking you to save me. I'm just asking you that you forgive me. I ended up trying, because in the past, normally if I moved around, then the medication would come up. But because it had sat for so long, it wasn't coming up. I stayed in that position until around, I want to say, 3:30 to 4 o'clock that day, that afternoon. And I was like, Lord, if you give me the strength, I'll call for help. I ended up calling, like, Walmart at the time and asking them about this particular medication. And I ended up calling in third party. I don't know why, but I just did. And then they had me call Poison Control. And Poison Control was like, if you need to get to the hospital right now because your heart is getting ready to explode. And so I get to the hospital, and the psychiatrist, were all beginning to, interestingly, they were beginning to minister to me, and they were telling me some of their stories and what they had gone through. And I just remember sitting in the bed, and I was just like, just thinking, like, Lord, am I going to die? And I remember that doctor saying, I'm not going to let you die. And then he just walked out. But that next day, when our new doctor came in, because at that time with that medication, there was nothing that anyone can do. It had to run its course. And whatever would happen in the 24 hours would be, you know, was critical. The next day, another doctor came in, and he told me that technically, from the medicine that I had taken, my intestines should have exploded, but that there was a mass that covered it, that it didn't get a chance to reach to the other organs. But I was just so, at that time, just within those 24 hours, the Lord really showed me that you cannot go for a permanent solution for a temporary thing. You know, I was going, because of what I was feeling that day, I was going after something permanent. And the Lord was like, you cannot do this. And this is something that you will not do again. This is it. We will not continue to do this. This is it. And but I was just so amazed by the Lord that day, because he even made death behave. I had, all right, that day should have technically been the last day. And the Lord made death behave. And I was just like, Lord, I will not do this again. And I remember the psychiatrist man came into the room, and he said, I cannot send you to the hospital. And he said, it's not because, you know, this scared you so bad, but I have a feeling that you will never do this again. And he was right.
He said something very profound. Stop taking permanent solutions for temporary things. A lot of times for what we're going through at that time, it seems so bad, and it seems like the end of the world. So that was a very profound statement right there. Can you talk to our listeners about cutting, like if they're, because you said that you could say all the right things and you knew how to mask it. Can you talk to our listeners, especially parents out there, to know, or teachers even, to know the signs of a cutter? If there's a young person in their area that is cutting, what are some of the things that they can look for to know, especially if they're very good at masking like you were? What are some signs that they can take note of?
If you notice that the behavior has changed drastically, sometimes when I was very outgoing, but at certain times of the day or whatever, like especially in classes, you can tell that person is very withdrawn. With parents, you'll start noticing that, or if your child starts all of a sudden wearing long sleeve shirts and it's summertime, or around you they're wearing long sleeve shirts, or when they're normally not wearing them, it's a sign that they're covering up something sometimes. A lot of kids now are no longer cutting on the wrist because one is so obvious. So now they cut at the top, where it's the stomach, the thighs, somewhere where it's not as noticeable. But the main key thing is just to ask. You know, talk with your youth, or talk to your child about what's going on. You know, if you notice such a drastic change, it's a change in the attitude. You know, and all of a sudden they're outgoing and they're not outgoing anymore. Something's up. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're cutting at that moment, but after a while, something has got to give, you know, for them. You know, it's either going to be drugs or cutting or whatever it is. Because the thing about depression, it is so deep, you know, and it's rooted in there. So, like I said, each person is different. For me, it was a mere fact that my behavior changed so much, and I was not talking about it. And right. I felt like what I was going through, nobody was really listening or wanted to listen.
Wow. Okay. So you are 14 years old now, and mm-hmm. and they put you in a foster care system.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So did the cutting get worse, or, you know, were you doing more things that were destructive to your body? Talk to us about that time period of your life at 14.
Yeah, when I was placed in foster care, it got worse. Because it's so, well, the foster homes and group homes that I went had so many different kids, you know, different staff, that you were able to hide a little bit more. It really got worse. I was trying everything. I went from drinking bleach to cutting to just those things, because it was so drastic for me. I wanted out. I wanted out. There was no point in living. I had social workers and people. I couldn't even have a thought without telling it to my social worker, and then my social worker deciding yes or no on a situation. And then, you know, everyone had an opinion, and I didn't. I felt like I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, if this is the case, then I'd just rather not be here. One less child that you have to make a decision for. I feel like I was a disgrace to my family, you know, being in the foster care system and all that. And now I'm in this system where, you know, just going in and out of homes, in and out of group homes. I just felt like
wow.
It was pointless.
Wow, if you are just tuning in, I am talking here with Kim Brownie Hodge. Kim, let's talk about how many different foster homes that you were in? Do you know approximately how many?
I went to 6 different foster homes, and I went to 3 group homes, 2 group homes, I'm sorry. One of them I stayed in for 2 years.
Okay. Let's talk about your first foster home, because you were in there with, what was it, 8 or 18 girls?
18 girls. My first group home.
18 mm-hmm. other girls. So did you get along with those girls? Was it tough being that it was 18 of you? Talk about that situation.
I got along with everyone, but it was still hard. You know, you have 18 girls, 18 different personalities, 18 different stories of why girls are in there. You were liable to see anything, you know. It was really tough from going from, you know, your normal surroundings to a big group home, like facility. We saw girls who, there was only 3 of us at that time that actually went to school off grounds. Everyone else was going to school on grounds, and it was just really different. It was hard to adjust. It was really hard to adjust, and because
did
I was
you each have
stuff,
your own room?
No.
Did you have to share a room? How many were in
yeah,
a room?
Yeah, we all shared them. Depending on the age, it could be up to 2 to 3. But the room I was in, it was just 2 of us.
Okay. So, okay, you're 14. 15, 16, you're going in and out of foster homes. In school, you're still maintaining a BC kind of average. Were you involved in school activities at this time?
Not when I first got into the foster care system, no. I started doing dance when I was a junior in high school.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And was dance your outlet?
It was. Dance was my voice at that time. I didn't really know how to express what I felt with my words. So even with communicating with the Lord, I would dance things out. I mean, I could talk surface, like with casual conversations. Like I could do that. But when it became to those intimate matters, those things of the heart, I just, you know, dance was the only way that I knew how to express what I was feeling.
Wow. Okay. So you're now 18 years old, and you're getting ready to graduate from high school and kind of leave these foster care systems, and it's time to go to college, and you're thinking about going to Langston University. Talk to us about that period of your life.
Well, at that time, I was transitioning out of foster care. So to start that off, it was a fight for me to leave the foster care system just because of all the suicide attempts that I had, because I was trying to commit suicide, so it was hard for the system to say yes. So I had to set up a support system in order for me to leave the foster care system to transition into college. I think at this time I was so excited about leaving and going to Oklahoma because I felt like if I can get away from California, all my issues and my problems would just stay in California and I'll be able to go to Langston and just start a whole new life. But little after I got to Langston, I realized that what I didn't deal with in California followed me all the way to Oklahoma still.
I couldn't hear you. Little did you know what? I'm sorry.
I said, little did I know that the issues and the problems that I had in California followed me to Oklahoma.
Oh, okay. So you had to actually be emancipated in order to go to college through an attorney and a support system that you had at that time. So you got emancipated, you go to college, you're thinking that, you know, you're going to get away from your problems and your problems followed you there. How was your life different once you got to college?
In the beginning, I felt like it was good because I wasn't under the state, you know, eye anymore. I felt like I had a new slate, you know. At first, things were going good, but then I fell back into this area of masking again, and where I started noticing that I wasn't fitting in with other students because I didn't have the same background they had. When they would talk about certain subjects, I felt like I couldn't really get into their conversations. That part was kind of difficult, and so I kind of started stepping back, and then I started looking at my life again. You know, even though I was active in school, I was active in the church and whatnot, but it was just those things from the past were starting to rear its head. And I want to say my freshman to sophomore year is when I started back, you know, going back.
Going back to wanting to thoughts
old
of suicide?
Behavior. Yeah, I had thoughts of suicide, just depression. But I was masking it so well that other people didn't even know what was going on.
You had an encounter with a professor your sophomore year during that time. Talk to me about that conversation with your professor.
My sophomore year, I ended up, I just couldn't no longer continue to wear the mask anymore. I felt like I was living a double life. Outside looking great, but bleeding on the inside, I just felt like I wasn't going to make it. So I went to this professor, and I let this professor know that I needed help. And I remember this professor telling me that, well, you need to go to the church and let the church cast out this demon in you. You need to, you know, just pray about it and all those things. And I was like, she was like, and then she made this statement that, you know, black girls don't cut. We don't do things like that. And I was just like, well, this one does. You know, this one, you know, it's not to when you're hurting, you're not looking at color. You're not looking at a book that says what black girls do, what Caucasian girls do, what Hispanic girls do. You're not looking at that. You just know that you're hurting and you need help. And when she said, well, we don't do this, and you just need to go to church, I was already active in the church. I was dancing in the church. I was serving in the church. I was working with the youth of the church. So I was just like, well, I might as well go back to church and do what I was doing in the beginning. And, you know, I was just kind of like, okay, well, I'm just going to go back to business as usual. So I continued to dance. And while I was sitting in church, I would just be like, okay, well, at the end of this service, I would just be thinking of how ways I was going to end my life. And people never knew about it. We would be sitting in church, and I would dance, and then when I'm done, I'm sitting right next to you, and you had no idea that I was going to do anything, because I knew, I hate to say the church logo, I knew what to say, you know, to make it look like it's okay. You know, I knew how to wear that church mask. I knew how to make it sound good.
Wow.
I was like, if I couldn't even get... Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, no. I was like, if I reached out to this professor and she didn't even, what she gave me back in return, I was actually becoming vulnerable. Like, you would never get that from me asking for help. And when I came to you and that's the answer I got, I just, it was like there was no point.
Right. What, is there something that that professor could have said to you? Other than what she said, what at that time, what did you need for the professor to say?
I think I just kind of needed that listening ear. Someone to say that, you know, we're going to make this over, you know, that we can get through this, that I'm standing with you. Looking at even some other resources or something, you know, that I couldn't get on my own. And when she did that, it was like kind of like a door slammed in my face.
Right. So basically at this time, you're feeling like, I go to church, I dance at the church, I work with youth at the church, I serve at the church, and I'm still inside, I'm dying.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. It just goes to show that, you know, I was just at church on Sunday, you know, and there could be someone sitting next to me going through that. And you never know, because they're smiling and they're pretending that they're fine and they're wearing the mask that you're talking about, but inside, you know, their whole world is crumbling. So, okay, talk to me about Mercy Ministries. How did you end up at Mercy Ministries?
My sophomore year, I ended up having a suicide attempt. I ended up going to the hospital, and I remember just sitting there. I was like, mm-hmm.
1 second. This was the 29th attempt that we talked mm-hmm. about a little bit earlier. Okay. So this was the 29th attempt, and so that's how you ended up at Mercy?
Mm-hmm. And I remember being in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
No, there's a slight delay in the phone. So you ended up being in the hospital. Go ahead.
Right. And I was in there, and I was just remember crying out to the Lord. I was like, Lord, if you're not going to die, if you're not going to let me die, then you're going to have to help me live.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say the next day I saw Nancy and Cece Winans on TBN, and I was listening to the girls sharing their testimony, and I just applied for the ministry after doing some little research on what it was. I never thought that I was going to get into the program as quick as I did. I ended up going to Mercy, and that was where I ended up really becoming, well, when I first got there, I was really nervous. So that first month, I wasn't really trying to give the program a chance because of everything that was around me. I want to say, mm-hmm. like, just the distractions. I felt like I was an oddball out. So, you know, when you're praying for help and when the Lord makes help available, sometimes you're kind of nervous about walking into that, you know. And so when I walked in there, I just looked at wasn't what I felt like wasn't in place or whatever the case was. And so I was just really having a hard time. I was just like, I don't want to be here. I'm just ready to leave. But I remember saying I was going to leave, and Mercy just asked me to go to the Joyce Myers Conference and just kind of stay and until after the conference. And after that conference, I realized more that I needed to stay in this program, because if I did not, I was going to die.
Let me talk to our listeners about Mercy Ministries. Mercy Ministries is a program based now in Nashville, Tennessee, but they have locations all across the country and even other countries. It's a Christian residential program for young girls suffering from physical and mental abuse, as well as life-controlling issues such as cutting or eating disorders, or, you know, if people are suicidal. So they house them free of charge in this facility. And so Kim ended up there. And so Kim, at this time, now you're juggling these masks. You are dealing with fitting in at Mercy Ministries, and you're battling these things in your mind. What did Kim look like on the outside? What did you look like on the outside?
On the outside, I looked fine. On the outside, I looked fine. But on the inside, I was in turmoil. Even just because I hadn't let down those walls. So it just felt like when I was there, the first month, it was hard. But as I started letting those masks fall and started really becoming vulnerable, things began to change. I began to be more accepting of certain things. You know, I was looking at worship styles. I was literally like, I felt like I was nitpicking at so many different things, because I was scared and nervous and just different things. But when I started really sitting there and taking it for what it was, you know, and allowing the Lord to really come in. Now, we've always been about corporate worship, but now it was, emphasizing on personal relationship with the Lord, you know. And I remember every day, it would just, after those 2 months or whatnot, the Lord used to come, and this little voice would just be like, Kim, do you trust me? And I would be like, yes, I trust you. And he'd be like, no, you don't. But yet, I was still getting revelations. I was still getting breakthroughs. I was still getting these things. And I was like, well, if I didn't, then I wouldn't be getting this. And he was like, that's not necessarily true. You know, so I want to say that fifth month was my breaking point at Mercy. I mean, the staff were kind. They were patient. They were loving. They were, you know, they were accepting. You know, they pushed and they encouraged. But there comes a point in time when you need to be active as well in your own breakthroughs and your own transitions. And there comes a point where you need to be active and not, you know, and that's where I had to come in, you know. And even though I was pushing in different stuff, there was another place that I needed to go in, you know, and that's the place that the Lord wanted. He was like, yes, you have this part out, and this is great. You've given me this, but I'm coming now. I'm coming after that hurt. I'm coming after that deep place, that place that you don't even think that I see. I'm coming for that. And that's where that do you trust me part came from. And I remember the fifth month being at Mercy, and I was reading a leadership book. And it was just a Joyce Meyer leadership book, and I think I was only in like 2 or 3 pages, and I got so angry. And the Lord asked again, and he was like, do you trust me? And I was like, no, I don't trust you, because you let this hurt come. You let these people leave me. And all these things were coming up. And I felt like I was just giving the Lord everything that I had. You know, I was just like, you know, letting him know. And I remember just a small voice came in and said, now we can work. And it was just, he was saying that. And then it was like, I can't heal that mask, but I want to heal the person behind the mask. As long as you have that mask up, I can't do anything with it. But when you decide to take that mask off, then that's when healing and breakthrough and deliverance will come to play. But I will not compete with a mask.
Wow. So let's talk about the mask for a minute. You said to me in a statement the other day that masks can only last but for so long before you have to put the next one on. Explain what you meant by that.
Because I was living because I had so many different masks. I had my church mask, my school mask, my friendship mask. I had all these different masks. And when you start getting to a place where you're broken or you're just weighing down, you forget which mask to put on. You know, it's like an expiration date on a mask. You can only wear them for so long before you become exposed. You know, your mask will expose you eventually, or you'll take it off in front of the wrong group of people, and they'll see you for what you are. And I was trying to be perceived as a person that had it together, that I was strong, you know, because I would base off, if I knew that a person was hurting and that was my friend, I wouldn't go to you with an issue or problem because I knew exactly where you were. And with my friends, I knew exactly where they were, so I didn't have an outlet. So I just kept everything on the inside. So at that time, I was just like, well, I'm just going to wear these masks. And the mask was strength at times where I was weak. So these masks were coming off because they were showing who I truly was at that time, you know, and... Mm-hmm. So,
you said to me that masks are deadly and that they're hard to breathe behind.
Mm-hmm. Masks can kill you if you let them. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Go ahead, keep going, because you said some really profound things. I'm actually writing a message on masks, so I'm taking notes. I hope the listeners are taking notes about it as well, but... You said that masks are hard to breathe behind and they'll suffocate you.
I got that expression when I was dancing because I was praise dancing, and I praise dance behind a mask. And it's so hard to breathe, but it's the same thing when you wear masks. You begin to suffocate behind all those different layers that you are trying to cover up. You're trying to cover up your real self, and you just keep putting these masks on and just putting one after another. And after a while, you can't breathe. You feel like you're suffocating. Like it's literally hard to breathe.
Wow. Okay. So at Mercy Ministries, you're dealing with the mass, you're dealing with developing a relationship with God. That had to be tough, learning to trust God and develop a relationship, given that prior to this, you never had a relationship with anyone that you can trust, especially your family members. Talk to me about that whole process.
I trusted people, but I trusted them to a certain place. You know, I would let people in this far, this person, the next, that person, you know, a certain distance. When I came with the Lord and I was, you know, when I was at Mercy and that relationship, that was hard, you know, because I was so used to, yeah, but I know the Lord can do this. I know the Lord can do that. But he was now requiring, he was requiring me, the whole package. And I was like, how can I trust you to, you know, to protect me? If I, you know, it was just like, I just couldn't trust him that much. You know, I felt like I couldn't. But as time progressed and the Lord began to show me how I could trust him, you know, it was a process. I'm not going to say it happened overnight because I had to lay down, of course, those hurts and those things that I felt like I was in right standing holding against him when it was wrong, you know. But it was a process. I began to say, Lord, okay, if I'm going to know you as a healer, then show me that you're a healer. If I'm going to stand on you're a father, then show me, because I don't know what this looks like. I don't know what... You know, this father looks like. I don't know what this, you know, you call, you know, I need you to show me what these things look like. And the Lord began to show me these different things, you know, once I became vulnerable and wanted to, but I had to start kind of saying in the mornings when I woke up, Lord, I choose to trust you today, because then I felt like I was starting my morning off trying to do that, like not just saying it, but it was a desire, like, Lord, I trust you today. I don't know what that looks like all the way, but I choose to trust you today. Because the Lord began to show me how he was there for me in different places. That night that I had that breakthrough with him where I became really vulnerable, the Lord began to show me, Kim, I was here. When they sold you, you didn't even know what else they were plotting. I was there. I was there. You know, when other people tried to take advantage of you, I was there. I covered you. When your family was trying to, you know, desired your life, I'm the one that pulled you out of there. But I couldn't see it because it was, you know, I was in a lot of pain and hurt, so I couldn't see those things that the Lord was trying to say. But when I became more vulnerable and I started bringing those walls down, the Lord began to reveal certain things. In some areas, it was easier to trust him, like, oh, okay, I trust you right here. But in other places, it was kind of tough. But he, you know, he was so patient. The Lord was so patient. And I hate to say this, he gave me a reason to trust him. You know, it's like something that should come automatically because he's God, you know. But he gave me a reason. You know, he showed me that I am worth you trusting. I'm worth you relying on, you know. And these things that happen, I promise you I'll turn it around for you. Just give me a chance to show you. And he has. And he continuously does.
Wow. Explain the mercy bubble. This is a concept that you all refer to. Most of the graduates of Mercy Ministries call it the mercy bubble. Can you explain that to our listeners?
What we call the mercy bubble is because when you first come into Mercy, you stay in the program for 6 months. So you kind of not have any contact with the outside world, I would say. You have contact with your family or some friends. You can do letters or you can do phone calls or even for some people, visitation, you know, at the home or for the weekend pass. But besides that, we really don't have any access to the outside world. You know, we may go on little trips, but nothing. I mean, if you're in college like I was, you weren't able to kind of bring in homework assignments or anything. So you designated 6 months to Mercy, which your day would consist of, you know, praise and worship, Bible reading, counseling, some activities, you know, classes. That's what we call the mercy bubble, because for 6 months you're just focusing on you. It's a mirror of you.
Mm-hmm.
So anything else that is a distraction or hindrance, they don't kind of allow.
Right. So, okay. So you're in this mercy bubble where there's no outside distractions, hindrance.
Mm-hmm.
Your aunts aren't there. Your family's not there.
No.
Talk about how you are feeling emotionally, because before you said that you were numb, you were dead inside,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't show emotion. So you used to cut because
mm-hmm.
the blood was your tears at that time, and that's how you knew you were alive. Talk about emotionally how you felt in the mercy bubble. Was it different? In that space.
It was different. It was really different. For the particular home that I was in, just things were different. Like I said, the worship was kind of different from what we were, you know, used to. It was just really different for us.
What do you mean the worship was different? Explain to us how the worship was different.
Well, you know, in different churches we have different, you know, music. We have different stuff. And from coming from my background, we have more of a gospel, that's the best
mm-hmm.
thing, the gospel feel of things. And it was getting adjusted to this different worship. And it wasn't bad by all means. But
it was more
different.
Contemporary gospel, our God is an awesome God.
Yes.
He read more of that music than hand clapping, foot stomping, screaming music. Okay.
It was just
a
little bit different. But it was just the surrounding. Mm-hmm. Like I said, when you first come into a place, you're kind of looking at everything, you know, just figuring out what's out of place, and, you know, just for whatever reason, your insecurity level, that was
mm-hmm.
me. And so I just felt like there was nobody that was looking like me. You know, I felt like the oddball out until I started letting those walls down and then realizing that it doesn't even matter if we look alike or if we don't. You know, we came here because there was something greater. You know, that
right.
we needed to deal with, and that was our lives that were at stake at that time. So but those little distractions in the beginning, boy, they'll get you. They'll
mm-hmm.
get you. But it was.
So emotionally, were you starting to feel more? You know, like if you felt sad, did you just cry at this time? Or if you felt mad, or did you just get angry at that time? Like, were you showing more emotion when you were in the mercy bubble?
Yeah, I did. When I started getting frustrated about certain things, because now it was a safe place for you to talk. You know, you had your counselor. After you developed that that rapport with her, you felt like you could talk with her. At Mercy, in particular, I had a great counselor that I could talk with, you know, and there was no judgment, you know, no judgment. You know, she actually sat there and listened to what I had to say, because for once, I mean, I would talk about little things, but I would never go into real details about events. So at that time in the mercy bubble, because you see these people every day, you begin to develop a relationship. And so with this counselor, she made the environment safe, you know, where I could talk about what was going on. I didn't feel like there was judgment. I didn't feel like somebody, you know, I just didn't feel that. I didn't feel like things were my fault, you know. I would take responsibility for things that I felt like I'd done wrong or whatever the case was. But in time, I began to start crying, you know, about things. I would get upset about things, emotions that I would not generally express. I was starting to express more. And it was awkward in the beginning. You know, it was just like, what's going on? Because it was like, you need to be strong. You don't need to be shedding any tears. Why are you shedding tears? Those things have happened. It's over. Get over it. You know, that was like my mentality. And now it's like, I'm going from that to like actually crying.
Wow. Okay. I think we have a question. Ebony, are you there, Ebony?
Hello. Hello.
Ebony, are you there?
Hello?
Do you have a comment or a question?
Oh, I was really listening to your conversation. I thought it was really interesting story. I have a show on Blog Talk, and we talked last week about the masks that people wear. And it was interesting to hear your guest talking about the mask that she wore, particularly around church. I'm always interested in that side of things, because I think that's a place where we can hide a lot of stuff. And it's very easy to kind of live a pretense about who we are and what it is that we are doing. Do you think that your story, I mean, your story is a very, very, very emotional story and a really interesting one too. Is that something that you have shared with young people? Or is it a story that you're only sharing for the first time? You know, is that something? So I hear it, and I wonder if some of our teenagers could benefit from hearing about your life.
That's a really good question, Ebony. Kim, you want to answer that for her?
Yes, from what I could hear. I do share my story with young adults, and it's, you know, whomever I feel I can benefit from it, you know. But I didn't catch the rest of it for some reason.
She said you had a very interesting story, and she wanted to know if you ever share that with young people, or if this
yes.
is the first time that you're sharing this story.
No, this is not the first time. No, ma'am.
Okay.
Ebony, I will say, Kim was being very modest, but through Mercy Ministries, she was able to speak to young people, thousands of young people, and her along with some of her other Mercy Ministry sisters, and they developed their testimony, and they learned how to share their story. And she actually was a part of I have an event called an out-of-the-box experience that I was doing in my hometown. And Kim came in front of hundreds of people and just kind of shared her personal story. And each time she shares it, she gets better. I've seen tremendous growth in her delivery of the story, and I can tell that she is forgiving and forgiving herself, and she's growing from this experience. And each time she shares her story, it's taken layers of mask off of her. And so we're incredibly grateful that she is on the show today and being so transparent and sharing her very personal story with us. That was a good question, Ebony. Thank you. If you want to ask another question, I'm going to put you on hold, but just press 1 if you want to ask another question, okay?
All right. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So you are listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crowley. I have here with me Kim Brownie Hodge, who has shared her story about being sold across the street by her aunt to two men, and how she was able to go to college. She was emancipated enough to go to college because of her suicide attempts. She had to go through a process in order to even go to college. And then in her sophomore year, she found out about Mercy Ministries. And for anybody that is interested in Mercy Ministries, their website is www.mercyministries.org. And it's spearheaded by Nancy Alcorn, and they're located in Nashville, and the phone number is area code 615-831-6987. And it's a free residential program for young girls suffering from abuse or any life-controlling issues. So if you know of anyone that is remotely similar to that, this is definitely a ministry for them. Kim, now... Mm-hmm. Obviously, at this facility, at Mercy Ministries, there had to be some girls who didn't grow up in a church who said, I'm not doing all these Bible studies and Bible devotions and praying out loud, you know, and all the things that were required of you while you were in the Mercy bubble. Did that ever happen, or did you feel that way at times?
There was definitely girls that would come in there and that they were not raised in the church, you know. But during some process, you know, during the course of time, you would see the change that would happen in their lives where they would establish a relationship with the Lord, or some people would just, you know, find out that this is not what I want and they'll eventually leave.
Mm-hmm.
But did you
ever feel like that?
That I wanted to leave?
Yeah, I mean, you had a regimen every day where you had to get up early in the morning, you got to make your bed, you got to pray for worship, you got to pray out loud. I mean, was there ever a time where you felt like, look, I'm not doing this. I don't want to be here.
You would definitely have those moments where, you know, sometimes the harder part, you know, of the week was the weekends because they were kind of longer, you know, but like I said before, when you start realizing why you're there, because, of course, you have those days you're like, I just want to sleep in. I don't want to do this today. You know, of course, you have those days. But when you're sitting there and what made the difference from me leaving to staying was because of the progress that I saw in myself. And I began to feel, for once, that I was breathing, you know, that I was, that there was hope. You know, there was that, you know, things started to become alive, you know, things began to waken up that had been dead for so long. So when you looked at, okay, do I really want to leave right now or do I want to finish my progress, you know, finish this program out, and I just end up staying. Because of what I fought for, you know, you're fighting this whole time, you know, so I felt like I fought so hard that I wanted to finish.
All right. So what was the turning point for you while you were at Mercy? Like, what made you stay there?
I want to say the reason why I ended up staying at Mercy is because I knew I needed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
When I looked at what I was dealing with prior to coming into the program, you know, it wasn't, you know, I'm like, I need to give this program a chance. This might be my last chance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I need to give this a chance because you feel like you can't go to the back and, you know, back to your past, and you can't go and forward, you know, forward because you don't know what's up there. You don't even know if you're going to live to see it. So all I have is this moment right now. That's all I have.
So you went to a Joyce Meyer's conference.
Yes.
And it seems as if that was really a timeout moment for us. Can you share that experience with our listeners?
Yes. During that part, the first month that I was at Mercy, I wanted to leave. I got word from our person at the home, and she was saying that I couldn't leave until after the Joyce Meyer's conference. I ended up going to the Joyce Meyer's conference, and T.D. Jakes spoke that first night. And I'll never forget his message. And he was talking about if you're not receiving anything on the right side of the boat, then you need to cast your net on the opposite side. You know, and I felt like that was speaking so much volume to me. I had been fishing on this side for so long and continuously getting the same result, you know. And I was like, well, I'm going to do something different. I'm going to cast this on this other side. And if it worked, then good. But if it didn't, then I'll, you know, at least I can say I tried. And I'm glad that I did cast that out. But it was that message that he delivered that night that really, really just sowed a seed.
Wow. So he basically said, if you're fishing on one side and you're not catching anything, then you need to cast your nets on the other side.
Other side. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. So you had a breakthrough moment at this conference, and you went back to Mercy Ministries and you stayed.
Mm-hmm.
When you got back to Mercy, were you in a better place? Were you genuinely ready to give the program a try at this point?
I was. I actually, when I came back, I felt like, okay, I'm going to give this 110%. I even went out and got a, I guess that Friday, it would be our mall day. So I went out and got a journal, and I still have it to this day. It's pulled up. And this marks the day of the new beginning of my life. And that was just a walk through Mercy. It was the journey journal. And because I wrote down everything that I had gotten from the Joyce Meyer conference, but it was the journey. That was my journey journal.
And so at this point, is that when you really started to develop a deeper relationship with God after you returned back to Mercy?
I started developing one. Mm-hmm. At that time, I started becoming more open to what the Lord had to say. You know, not that I hadn't been before, but it was like on a personal playing field.
So were you starting to pull off the mask at this time?
Mm-hmm. I was starting to become more vulnerable. I was like, if I'm going to walk this thing out, I'm going to walk it out. But I would take it day by day. You know, I would just day by day. You know, I wasn't trying to rush into tomorrow. I was just trying to do well in today. What could I do today that I didn't do yesterday that would make, you know, just steps. I just took steps.
So tell us the difference between taking off the mask with God versus taking off the mask with people, where people could see who you were. What was the difference for you at that time? What was the difference between the two?
I think with God, it was a little bit, you know, different. I think when you start establishing a relationship with God, then those masks in front of people begin to kind of just come off, you know, little by little. I started noticing that it was easy for me to be vulnerable with the Lord is taking off those masks because he allowed me to, you know, versus with people, I was always skeptical because, you know, everyone always has an opinion about stuff. And I maybe kept those on just a little bit longer when it came with people, just because everything that, you know, I had gone through, and I just didn't want to, you know, make people look bad or, you know, any of those things. But when it was with the Lord, I just felt like I could actually be Kim. I can just simply be Kim and not anything else.
Okay, so let's talk about, so your six-month bubble, your Mercy bubble, ends. Talk about when you left the Mercy bubble, and just talk about your first few moments when you went back to school and you're living life outside of this bubble that they created for you.
Mm-hmm. When I left Mercy, I felt like, I was ready. And when I left out, I had an amazing support system. Before you leave Mercy, they make sure that you have an accountability partner for at least 6 months. And so I had a great accountability partner, and I had a great support system that really helped me. When I was going back to school, because I had left to go to Mercy, I had professors that were really skeptical of, you know, Mercy and the process because they never heard about it and all these different things. But after a few months being there, they began to see some of the progress that took place. But I went back and, you know, back to school, got back active, and, you know, I was choir president. I was, you know, mentoring. I actually even did events on campus about Unity Day, which was basically to bridge the gap between students and faculty and staff, and I just felt like because of the freedom that I had gained, I wanted to be able to share with everyone. You know, I wanted people to know that freedom was available and that where they were, they didn't have to stay there. So I felt like I just became more tangible with people, you know, not with the mask. I wasn't, you know, really hiding behind those as much or, you know, but I was starting to reach out more, you know, versus talking to someone in secret in the corner. I didn't mind opening up to you about what was going on, you know, especially if I seen there was a hurt there.
So talk about Unity Day. What exactly happened at Unity Day, and did you share your story at the Unity Day?
At Unity Day, we actually put the event together, and basically with students that were actually coming out to share their testimony with other students. So it was an uplifting day, you know. We had students that actually sang, mimed. We had a few students share their testimony. I didn't share my testimony that particular day. I just allowed other students to because I felt like these are the students you see every day. If you could see, like I was graduating, so I felt like if they could see these students and a reminder that if they made it, then we can make it, you know, that there was still support that was still on the campus. But I just felt like after praying about it, I didn't feel the need to share what was going on. But just to get the organization together, you know.
Right. So at this time, did you start to have compassion and discernment for other people like you?
Well, I always had compassion for people. You know, that was my heart, you know, helping people has always been the main thing. But I think now I was able to see different things in people, you know, when certain behaviors weren't right. You know, or when someone seemed like they weren't okay, it was easier for me to go to you and ask you, are you okay, versus, you know, sometimes we wait for people to come to us, and now make an initiative, like, something's not right about that person, let me just check on them. You know, I would go to strangers and be like, are you okay? You know, just simple things like that, because you could pick up on that thing, something's not right. It didn't necessarily have to be them cutting, but you can pick up on something.
Wow, so that's become your ministry. After Unity Day, did people start confiding in you on campus? Did you become more of a mentor on campus because you organized this whole movement of Unity Day?
I was already a mentor before Unity Day, but there were more people that were actually coming and asking me questions about what I had gone through. A few, you know, it was a lot more people that came that way. But because it was my senior year and we had this Unity Day in the spring, you know, I wasn't doing a whole lot more mentoring. I was more on, you know, getting prepared for graduation.
Okay. We have a question. We have a listener by the name of Rex. Rex, are you there? Do you have a question?
Yes, I am here. I do have a question. I'm curious about healing, and particularly recognize that you were victimized by men, and as an African-American male, first of all, I apologize on behalf of anyone that was abusive to you. Your story is so compelling. But I'm curious about your healing and the extent to which you were able to forgive and how you move on and what your relationships with men are like now.
Okay. I was able to forgive, you know. I believe I was telling Sylvia about this last week. The aunt that sold me, she actually got married 2 weeks ago, and I was invited to go to her wedding. And the Lord really showed healing, you know, that I had really forgiven and let go of this situation with her. When I went to her wedding, I was her right-hand person, and there was no anger. There was no bitterness. There was nothing there but love, you know. And I believe when the Lord really delivers you, then it's that. But it was a process. I had to actually get to a place where I had to admit out of my own mouth that what happened and that it wasn't okay and that I had to get the help that I needed. But in just walking in a place of forgiveness, you know, you have to choose to forgive. And that's what I chose to do. There's no, you know, I hold no resentment, no anger towards her or my other aunt or the men that violated. You know, I just chose to walk in that area. And when it pertaining to men, I'm currently now married. So with that, you know, with healing, you know, and it allowed me to start, before I married my husband, acknowledging and going under, you know, mercy and, you know, forgiveness, I'm sorry. It just really helped me to see that all men weren't the same, that everyone's agenda is not the same, that there are genuinely good people out there, there are genuinely good men out there, that heart is not to take advantage, that is not to do wrong, you know, and it's not my place to make you compensate for what somebody else did.
Wow. Thank you, Rex, for that question. That was actually part of our grand finale, but we're just going to go with the flow since it was a smooth transition into that. I think it's incredible, Kim, that you were able to attend your aunt's wedding and actually serve her. You told me that you were putting on eyelashes, you were doing hair,
yeah.
You were doing all these sorts of things, and you know, this is actually the aunt that sold you across the street. And so,
yeah.
You know, a lot of times we hear this, that forgiveness is more about you, about freeing you than the other person.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true in your case, because it would have hindered you from progressing in terms of your life now, just being married. So I think that is commendable that you're actually able to face your aunt and forgive her. And you said something, your healing process began when you said out of your mouth, you did this to me and that was wrong. You know, you actually said those words and then you were able to move on. So Rex, we thank you for that question. Kim, let's move forward. Let's talk about graduation, because when you think about all the things that you went through, and you know, you're sitting next to people who, this is kind of like a party moment for them. They're thinking about the graduation parties and how much they're going to drink and how much money they're going to get in their graduation cards. And for you, it's about a moment of, first of all, you had to be emancipated to even go to college. So tell us the thoughts and the feelings that are going through your mind at that moment.
Well, Chris, graduation was, of course, a big time for everyone, but it was extra special for me. You know, it was humbling, you know. One, I had never thought that I would live to see graduation. No thought, never crossed my mind. I was the person that wished every year that I didn't live to see my birthday, you know. And every year I was like, Lord, don't let me see it, don't let me see it. And now I'm sitting along everyone else at graduation, you know. And it was just such, you know, I didn't have, you know, family, you know, biological family at graduation. But I had such, you know, my friends were there, you know, my church family was there, my God's family were there, you know. And I was talking to the Lord. I was like, Dad, thank you for being here for graduation. You know, and I looked at this moment as just, you know, everything that everyone had ever said about me, from social workers, you know, that I would never be able to think for myself, that I would never, you know, graduate, that I would just all these labels, to family labels, you know, that I was never going to be anything, and all these things. And it was like that day the Lord proved everyone wrong. He proved everyone wrong. It was like he said, I have the last say so. You have your opinions, but I have the last say so. You know, and just walking across the stage, and it was just like I held up my degree in the air, and you know, I dedicated this degree back to the Lord. But it was just that moment that, you know, whatever happened from this day, you know, back in the past, it's over. This is now a closed thing, and I'm walking in the future. You know, it's a new slate. It's a new thing. You know, it's just newness. Now it's my, you know, it's my chance to live. You know, for once I can live.
Wow.
And
not live to die, huh?
Not live to die. Right.
Wow. So, okay. So when you threw your graduation hat and your tassel up in the air like most graduates do, what were you saying at that moment in your mind?
I was just giving, just like I said, I was just giving it to the Lord, you know, like that time, you know, here, this is for what you gave me and I'm giving it back to you.
Wow.
Yeah.
What did you major in, Kim?
Psychology.
Why did you major in psychology?
I liked being able to help people, but I also wanted to know why people think the way they think or why they do the things that they do. It fascinated me.
Was that targeted towards your aunts? Why did they do the things that they do and behave the way they behave towards you? Or just in general, you just wanted to know in general?
Just a general thing.
Okay. So when you graduated, were you scared of what was next? You know, on graduation day, there are graduates who sit there, there's a speech that's given, and everybody's wishing you much success, and you have no idea what they mean by that, you know, given what you're facing at that moment. Were you scared of what was next for you after the graduation ceremony?
I was nervous for, like, maybe the whole month, you know, like April to May, because I didn't know, like, normally, I would be moved around every 2 years or after something completed. So it was like, I don't know what this next step is, you know. I was like, okay, I'm just going to park my car in a direction. I'm just going to drive in that direction. And wherever I end up at, I just end up at, you know. And I was just praying, too. I was like, Lord, I don't know what I'm going to do, you know, anything. And my god sister at the time, she, like, ended up, I believe, texting me, or I talked to her, like, that week or the week prior, and she's like, you can just stay with me. You know, the Lord was beginning to open up these avenues, you know, where I could go, because, like I said, normally I would just get up and go after 2 years or completion. I started getting antsy because I was always moved around so much. So it was like this door opportunity with her opened up, and I was able, you know, to live with her. And then the Lord opened up a job opportunity. And, you know, and just things were beginning to flow. And I think I even spoke with, like, our pastor mom, and she was saying that, you know, the Lord said, blessing, you have to stay still, that the blessings that the Lord has is going to come through Oklahoma to you, you know. And, you know, I was like, okay, you know, and just being still. And that was new, you know, because now I'm learning to trust the Lord on a different level. You know, he's seen me through college, and that was fine. You know, like, because you have a place to stay and all these things. But now I have to trust you on this different level. I have to trust you for a place, you know, a job. So it was nerve-wracking. But I have to say, before the end of that, up to graduation, the Lord had worked out these different areas.
Wow, that's interesting, because you said that every 2 years you felt like it was time for you to go because you had moved so much. And I think whenever you don't have roots, you feel like it doesn't matter if you leave. Like, no one will notice, and it doesn't bother me because I'm so used to packing up and going. So that must have been a very scary place for you to be in. You work for an organization called All Things New. Talk to our listeners about that organization.
I used to work for an organization called All Things New, and basically what that is I used to be a house mother there, and what we would do is we would rescue women who had been involved in sex trafficking. Once we found out that a girl was in some form of sex trafficking, we would set up a team. Either a team would go in and get them, or we would have a plane ticket ready for them to come to the home. And once they were in the home, that's when I would work with them, because I was their house mother. So I would get them adjusted to the home, and I started putting a program together where the girls would actually, if they wanted to go to school or what they wanted to do, whether it was a job related, after a certain amount of time, they were able to go to school. But I wanted them not to just focus on their issue, but to also be progressing towards something in the future. But basically my job was to keep these girls safe from whether it was their pimps or their boyfriends or whatever the case, whoever has them out there in this in sex trafficking.
So did you feel like you were being helped as you were helping these young ladies in some way?
I think in this area, the Lord was allowing me to be a voice for them. You know, I was learning to speak out more for the sake of these, you know, these young ladies. So I was growing. I would have to say I was definitely growing. Because there was other girls who depended on your voice.
There were other girls that depended. I couldn't hear the last
part. On your voice.
They
needed you
wow.
to speak to me. Because they had been, most of these girls had been beaten down so bad. You know, they wouldn't even, you would ask them, what would you like to eat for dinner? And they wouldn't even, to them they had no opinion. You know, they didn't have a say-so. So it was like you started to become their mouthpiece for a while until they learned to obtain that, or to know that they have a voice. So I remember being in their position, which made me encourage them even more to speak out.
Was there ever a young lady in the All Things New program that reminded you of yourself?
Oh, yes. It was one. She had, like, she was just a mini-me. She was definitely the mini-me. And, I mean, in so many different ways. And, but to be able to show her, you know, that she can make it past this point. But yes, it was one that was just like me. And when you see yourself, so, you know, it's just different. Very different.
Right. You said to me in a statement a few days ago that with everything that you were going through, you wore a garment of shame. But whenever you shared your story, the garments and the mask came off. About how many times do you feel like, do you think you've shared this story? Do you know approximately how many times?
Oh, I've shared it so many times. I've shared it so many times. The Lord really opened up an avenue, I want to say, in 2011. And I was able to share at Joyce Meyer's conference and different other conferences that year. And, I mean, people, you know, how other people perceive you. But I, just standing there and, you know, just declaring what the Lord has done, it felt like layers upon layers were falling off, you know, just off of you. Because you're like, in your mind, you're like, I'm getting free. You know, whether I'm on stage or if I'm in my house, I'm getting free, you know, and just, you know, you look back on what you've gone through and what the Lord has brought you out of, you know, and you just are so excited. You just can't help but express because you're like, if you don't know the God that I serve, I want you to get to know him because he is true about his word, you know, and I felt like I was just such a living testimony in this, and I was like, for the rest of my days, I just want to see people free, whether you're, you know, man, woman, older, you know, child, whatever. I want to see you free. I want to see those shackles fall off you. I want you to know that you can breathe and you can live and not die, you know, just standing there. And while I'm saying these things, I'm getting free, but I'm hoping I'm praying that you're getting free.
Okay, so you ended up back at Mercy Ministries, only this time to help out. In Oklahoma. Can you talk about that experience a little bit?
I just went it. Well, it was a brief time at Mercy. I just went and I ended up helping some of the girls that were there. I always like to, you know, to help out our Mercy sisters as much as we can. But it was just a time to be able to go back through the doors that you went through. And just to remind these girls that, you know, what you're doing is not in vain, that if you walk out this progress, if you walk this thing out, then you'll obtain this freedom. I'm not saying that your life is going to be perfect, but it'll be better than it was before. And just encouraging them in the process that, you know, don't get stuck on the walls, but get connected to God, you know, and that's the thing that they try to emphasize is building that connection with, you know, with the Lord. And that's what you, you know, that's what I feel good about going back to Mercy, is encouraging these girls. I know where it is. I know how it feels to be where you are, but I also know how it feels to be on the opposite side. And I just want to show you a glimpse of how it is on the opposite.
Right. So, okay. So you're currently in a master's program. What is your major?
Human family relations.
Human and family relations, you said?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. And what do you plan to do with that?
Eventually, I want to open up my own nonprofit organization, and just really, you know, help allowing people to know the word, you know, get into them, but I also want to connect them with resources, you know, that that can help them along the way, you know, through life. You know, it's good to have an established relationship with the Lord, but I also want to help them to get active in their communities or, you know, whatever resources that they need, and I want to have an agency that is able to meet those needs.
Okay. So you recently got married, shortly after
mm-hmm.
I got married, actually. So we were able to kind of
yes.
share that experience and that time together. You married Orville Hodge, Orville
yes.
as an Orville Redenbacher, right?
Yes.
Have you ever heard you tell this story, like your complete story? And just talk
yes.
about this, the process of you guys getting to know each other.
Mm-hmm. What? I actually met Orville while I was in college. You know, I was a freshman. He was going, you know, a junior. And I met him then, and we were friends. He ended up leaving to go to the military. And so we kept in contact. And so we ended up reconnecting while we were in Nashville, actually. And still, you know, still great friends. And so the day before he proposed, he actually came to an event where I was sharing my testimony. I had already let him hear the testimony. What I used to do is like, okay, I already had our testimonies on DVD and different things like that. And I was just like, okay, if you want to date me, then this is what it is, you know. Here it is. And then he actually came out and actually heard me share my story. And the next day, you know, he proposed. But one thing he did tell me the day before, he was like, I want to make sure that you're never hurt like this again. You know, and he, like, he apologized, you know, for the people that hurt me in the past. And he was just like, I want to make sure that you're never hurt like this again and that no one else comes and takes advantage of you like this. But he has been such an encourager, you know, and just such a God voice, you know. But, you know, the next day he ended up proposing, and September we got married.
Wow. Okay, real quickly, let's talk about just the planning and building up to the wedding, because this is a time typically where you have your mother through the process to help you find a dress, and your family attends and they sit on one side. And did you invite your aunts to the wedding? Like, oh, all these questions are going through my mind as I think about preparation for a wedding day.
Mm-hmm. I did invite family members, my biological family. I had one aunt that came to the wedding.
Not one of the aunts
the one,
that
was... No, that's only no. Another aunt came to the wedding. But on that day, or leading up to that day, the Lord really, really, really just laid out things so, you know, just before me. We had so much favor. I had so much help. I had my bridesmaids. I had my good friends, my God sisters, my spiritual family that were there. You know, I may not have had, you know, my biological family, but the Lord just brought so many family members in, you know, that were, you know, connected through maybe church or friendships or whatever the case was. On that wedding day, like you said, you know, your family sat on one side and, you know, his family sat on another. And it was just so cool, you know, it was full of people, you know, that were friends, but you couldn't just call them friends. They were like, we're your family, you know, and my
right.
and sat on that side. So it was like, even though I didn't have all of my biological family, it was the heart and the love of family, of friends and extended family, and, you know, surpassed. I didn't even know that I had, was even missing anything.
Right. Well, Kim, I just want to say that I'm so happy that you learn to shed the mask
and that you have a happy ending to your story where you got married and you're receiving now love from your husband and from, and you have a personal relationship with God and people in your life that support you. To our listeners, I want to say that if you are interested in Mercy Ministries, look it up, www.mercyministries.org. Kim, to you, I want to say thank you for coming on the show and sharing this personal story. I believe that God's going to bless you each time you share your story. And as you share it, more layers of your mask are going to continue to fall off of you and more healing is going to happen for you. So thank you so much for doing this for us. Is there anything that you want to leave our listeners with?
First off, I just want to say thank you for having me on the show. And just for our listeners, just that what you don't deal with will have a tendency to follow you. And it's just important that you address what's going on. I mean, you don't have to broadcast it to everyone, but get with someone that you know that you can talk with, that you can share what's going on. If you need help, do not be afraid or ashamed to go and ask for it. You know, don't look at the stereotypical of what, you know, one group of people do versus the other one. If you are hurting, then I just encourage you to just ask for help. Just ask for help. There, you do not have to be in a place of suffering any longer. Freedom is available.
Right. Well, this is Sylvia Crowley with Time Out. You're listening to Kim Brownie Hodges, and we encourage you to tune in next week where we have a special Father's Day tribute with comedian Michael Head. And we're out of here. We'll see you next week.
Tell me what you want, tell me what you want, tell me what you see, where you wanna go, what you wanna be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them. Then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight. Take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends. Twitter, you the trend, Ema Bentley Benz. But you moving kind of fast. Keep sweating, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last. But don't forget to have a blast.